listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host,
McGill.
It is the 4th of February, 2021, and what we have here for you is an episode 48. On my end, we're going to be wrapping up Operation Conqueror, the first operation of Al's Aces, which consists of a series of mini-adventures based on the Adventurers League module Defiance and Flan. So I'm going to be concluding that. And meanwhile, McGill is continuing his Eberron Touring Band game with an adventure module that we've heard about before, I think, on the podcast. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. This campaign has a few adventure modules that I've talked about, mostly in the tavern, on previous episodes. The Eberron campaign was the campaign that I discovered those modules for, and they've since become some of my all-time favorites.
It's funny because, I've in this campaign and going forward, a lot of the stuff I'll be talking about that I ran was based on Adventurers League modules, as I mentioned. But it's funny because, you know, I've had these Adventurers League modules on the side for ages, and in previous episodes, I've considered doing them and then thought better of it because I didn't want to spoil an adventure that I'd later basically be describing as the main part of the show. There's one exception. There's that great Mind Flayer adventure that I talked about, though that's that wouldn't be until like the next campaign, so still a ways off if I ever end up talking about that one. But still, point is, I've been kind of holding off on talking about my adventures, but it'll be interesting to hear your adventure, knowing that we previously heard a thing or two about the original source material.
That's right. Do you want me to kick it off in that case?
Well, I mean, we could. I know I made you kick it off last time.
Well, in that case, why don't you take it,
Tom? All right, switching it around just like that. As I think I had mentioned, well, so we left off Al's Aces, the new equivalent of Empok's Finest, the Drow Chessie, the Elf Nessalie, and the Goliath Ara Stormblast Kendor. They had just done a very routine Empok job, just clearing out what appeared to be a haunted crypt in Goblin Town. And returning, they were aware that they would be coming back to the Barking Dog Inn when a show was going to be happening. The Drow Bard Zeth Hexnat would be playing a show after they enjoyed lunch with him before their mission. And returning to the inn, they find that the show is just getting started and everyone's enjoying a feast of fresh fish food, fresh seafood and corn on the cob from the harvest that Abigail went out and got from the surrounding area. Yeah, it would be kind of disappointing if it was fresh fish food, but
Just some flakes.
Yeah, exactly.
No big deal.
But it's worth mentioning, like, if you look at the Draelic map, you'll see that Goblin Town is, like, right on the western coast, and so it makes sense that there'd be, like, decent access to the day's fishing hall. They return to the inn following their mission and in time for the feast, and the dinner and the show, basically. But while they are, you know, getting settled in to enjoy themselves, they are basically Abigail, the host, who's been sort of accommodating them while they stay at the inn. She comes over to them and basically reveals that they've received a tip that there is a potentially dangerous magical item somewhere in the inn. Someone has brought it to the show. And so this little mini adventure is based on one from Defiance and Flan called A Shock at Even Feast. And it's a very simple, short premise that is basically there are six tables around, some sort of festivity at the inn or whatever. And one of these six tables, the people at that table are secretly dealing in some potentially dangerous magical items. In the case of this game, it was someone had found an old piece, like a tiny old piece of Nightside Eclipse technology, was attempting to sell it on the black market via a deal made at this very dinner. But, of course, the whole trick is that the players don't know who has the volatile item, and therefore they either split up or they have to generally like go around sort of investigating the different people at the tables while not letting on that they know that something is going on in case they like spook the dealer and things go awry. So most of the design of this little mini adventure for me was just determining who would be at the six tables, like who would be the different suspects that the players have to investigate. So at the first table was a wood elf ranger named Beatrix, who had just finished a 2-week tour in the Land of Stench. She was wearing leather and had a blackwood bow that was like unique to the Land of Stench. Actually, it's also, I mentioned,
could they smell her from like across the room?
She probably had a bit of a stink on her, but also the shield that Arakendor was using was also a blackwood shield from the Land of Stench. So they already knew that this like wood was unique to the Land of Stench from having got an item of that type previously. So that's just like a little tie-in. Also, she had a potion of healing, which is like something to keep in mind. At the second table, there's a half-elf food critic named Ben. One trick here is that the players might try to use detect magic to figure out who has the magic item. But as is written into the mini adventure, a lot of the people happen to have magic items on them. So in the case of Beatrix, it's the potion of healing. In the case of Ben, the food critic, he has a magic pen. Also, he's wearing cologne, so he's not got a bad smell coming off of him. There's just like,
it's a real mix of smells.
Yeah, for real.
Just not to get off track or anything, but do you often describe like what the players smell? I try to make an effort, especially when players are entering like a unique setting where there would be a distinct smell. I try to go through like all five senses to really set the scene. So like dungeons often smell of like mildew and rot. But the way you're describing this scene, like all I can think is I would totally be like, it's this bizarre mix of like foul methane fart smell, but also like this sweetness of strong colognes and perfumes.
Well, and also of like freshly cooked food, and generally it's
and
like
fish,
that kind of
cooked fish as
it's,
well.
It's that yeah. It's that disorienting thing of like, okay, you're in a party and the party is in full swing and you have to do an investigation. I think that's generally what I was going for. As for describing smell in general, what you mentioned about like dungeons smelling dank and of mildew and rot and stuff, I usually don't bother with that. It's usually if there is a specific smell that I want to draw the character's attention to. One good example is that Odium, the founder of the Empok, when they met him, he was all like bandaged up and sort of like in this weird like life support situation, and I always go out of my way to describe Odium as having a lot of like basically like hospital smells, like smelling of like alcohol and very strong like sharp scents like that, which just sort of adds to like, man, what's going on with him? Like, is he alive? Is he sort of in like a weird sort of sustained state? So then table three is in fact the table where the black market dealers are. There's a human and a goblin. The human is named Lady Beverly, and the goblin is by the name of Zed. And Beverly owns basically what the players don't know is that Lady Beverly sort of runs effectively she is a drug lord. Who runs, like, there is a drug farm in the Land of Stench that she is, like, indirectly responsible for. And so the goblin, this goblin black marketeer is selling her this potentially valuable Nightside Eclipse tech so that she can potentially unlock its powers or use it. But neither of them, like, neither of these people are affiliated with the Nightside Eclipse, and neither of them really know what they're dealing with. It's just basically, it's funny, I literally took the imagery from Digimon, I think, where in, like, early seasons of Digimon, one of the things that the evil Digimon have in common is that, like, when they have these evil black cogs that make them evil that you have to knock out of them to free them from the influence of the cog. And so I just had, like, since the Nightside Eclipse is supposed to be this sort of technological threat, and they had last been seen in Goblin Town at the end of the last campaign, I wanted to have the idea that, like, some goblin had found, like, a piece of the last boss shuttle in MPOC's Finest or something, and was now trying to sell it on the black market as, like, potentially valuable salvage. But of course it is a dangerous piece of technology to have. This unstable Nightside Eclipse cog, while it is, kept in a jar by the black marketeers, should that jar become smashed in the commotion, which is one of the major risks of the investigation, the cog itself, puts out, harmful necrotic energy and, it does sort of temporary necrotic damage that would certainly be enough to potentially, like, cause a serious problem for, like, common folk in the inn at the time of the party. So that's the main risk. Like, it's not really a threat to the players because it only does a little bit of damage, but it's enough damage that, like, a commoner would have to worry about it. However, the other thing about it is that if a player were to seize the item for themselves and then keep it in their inventory without a containment, a container like the jar that it comes in, then it actually also provides vulnerability to lightning damage over time. And I screwed up earlier. It doesn't produce necrotic damage, it produces lightning damage. It's basically like an unstable piece of technology. But yeah, there's the idea that, like, while the mission was to seize the item and turn it over to the MPOC, there was the idea that, like, if a player decides that they want this for themselves for some reason, they may come to regret it, because it actually, if it is not bottled up, it confers a vulnerability to lightning damage. And then beyond that, you have table four. Or sorry, I said there were six tables. There's actually four, or five, my bad. But at table four, we have Z, a white dragonborn who is jumpy. It's her first time in Goblin Town. But by trade, she is actually a bloodhound, one of these smugglers from the southern capital of Stormgate, who operate along the salted seas of boiling blood, which we learned a bit about last campaign. So basically, she is like a smuggler who is in a foreign city for the first time, and she's generally, like, on edge. Basically, you know, as previously, you know, the first three tables I've mentioned, they would all trigger on a detect magic for various reasons. But in Z's case, she doesn't have a magic item on her, but she is a smuggler and she is kind of like on edge and has things to hide. And so insight checks may lead the players to think that she is hiding the item, but she is not, in fact. And then finally, there was a table with two, are you familiar with the Warhammer spin-off football game Blood Bowl?
I'm familiar with it, but I've never played it.
So just in a little reference to that, I had a couple of goblin blood bowlers at the last table by the name of Bob and Budwet. And Budwet was spelled Budwet, B-U-D-D-W-E-T, or Budwet, B-U-D-W-E-T-T, or Budwet, B-U-D-D-W-E-T-T, or Budwet, B-U-D-W-E-T.
Was he drinking a Bud Light? B-U-D-L-I-T-E?
Nah, he's just, Budwet was a champion blood bowler, and he actually, Budwet was also a randomly generated name that one of my brother's goblins got when he was playing the Blood Bowl game. And I was pretty pleased with it. I thought it was a good one. Budwet. But yeah, they're just there to, you know, they're jovial. They're revelers at a party. They're just there to have a good time. And have a bit of a roundabout conversation about how one of their names is spelled. And yeah, so I don't remember, but not a lot jumps out at me in terms of like how this session actually went down. I will say that, like, as opposed to how I've explained it on the podcast, the way this series of mini adventures played out for my campaign was like we did sort of the session zero and then the first session where they did the posing as dealers for the can of crimson stuff. Then we broke, and it was a separate session that we did the goblin hideout in the Land of Stench. Then we broke, and then did the crypt in Goblin Town and this session as one session. And then we broke and did the last mini adventure as a session on its own. So rather than breaking where we did last episode, we would have like carried over the adventure from last episode and mixed it with this one. But that's just to like explain how it sort of went down. The other thing is that like what I mean is I don't remember too much about this mini adventure. Basically what I think is that it just like the players did pretty well at securing the magic item and like keeping things under control so that like things did not spiral out of control in a very notable way. And so generally it was like they apprehended the culprits for questioning, they seized the item, they got a reward of 100 gold, and then they each got a healing potion. So it was just like a simple, you know, they got the job, things were tense, people were at risk, but they managed to get things done nice and clean. Nobody got hurt, and they managed to detain Lady Beverly for interrogation so that they could learn more about her whole operation, and this would in turn lead to the next and final session, wherein the mission that the Owl's Aces are sent on is to actually go and check out that drug farm in the Land of Stench that I had mentioned. Basically in suspicion with their involvement with this Nightside Eclipse technology. So jumping to the end, like jumping past this session, then I had basically the following day after this feast, the players got off, and so they had time to sort of like just kind of like free roam in Goblin Town and like do anything that they wanted. part of it was with the setup that, like, this was going to be the last mission in this series of, like, mini-adventures, and then they would be leaving Goblin Town. So it gave them a chance to sort of, like, explore the setting while they were still there. And Aura Kendor took the opportunity to see his old Goliath acquaintance, or his old best friend, Habna Cavefish Bress, another Goliath who was also, I mentioned the Bloodhounds earlier because that white dragonborn Z was one. Habna Bress is also a Bloodhound. So he is one of these smugglers that works across the border between Northern and Southern Drail as well.
So much blood and fish.
Well, I mean, it's the whole continent of Drail is cut in half by a channel of boiling salted blood. So, you know, a lot of work to be done there on the DMZ, smuggling things back and forth. Returning to the inn that night, there was basically, I had a little scene play out where it was like they come back and it's sort of last call at the inn, and they find their employer, Al-Samasath, or their handler at the Empok, drunk at the bar. And it was a negotiation that Nestle had with Al-Samasath that was basically, he was drunkenly sort of talking to her, like, because Nestle's aunt was Mealy, from the Empok's Finest, Al was kind of talking to her, like, you know, what did your aunt tell you about the Empok back when she was a part of it and whatnot? And she, like, mentions sort of the extent of what she knows from, like, stories within her family. But then what Al reveals while he is drunk, and this is, like, starting off what is one of the major plot points for Al's Aces, is back when Empok's Finest was started, the Empok was being run by its founder, Odium. And since the beginning of, like, since a point in Empok's Finest that we talked about previously in the last campaign, Odium has gone missing and no one knows where he is. And Al-Samasath is reluctantly filling in that leadership position, and in so doing, like, he's taking on this Al's Aces initiative as the follow-up to Empok's Finest. But there's this little, it was just this little scene to show that, like, in a moment of, like, drunkenness and uncertainty, he reveals his, like, very desperate situation where he's like, I mean, I was never the guy who was supposed to do this. I am filling in, like, some pretty big shoes here. And he's got some uncertainty about it. He's not sure that he can measure up. He's hoping to, but that little bit of uncertainty is something that, like, is very crucial or very central to the narrative of Al's Aces as it goes forward. The next day, they get their last mission, which is another rescue of an agent in the Land of Stench. The agent Abu, who was the goblin who was actually sort of basically was put in their training program as Al's Aces early on, not because he needed training, but as, like, a plant to sort of watch them and their progress. He has since been sent on his own missions in the Land of Stench and has become captured, not unlike the agent Axel, who was also captured in the Land of Stench at a goblin hideout a few missions ago. But this mission, as I mentioned, concerns the drug farm that Lady Beverly was connected to. Basically, there is a goblin-operated drug farm in the Land of Stench that may or may not have unknowingly connected itself to the Nightside Eclipse. And so the Empok, initially Agent Abu was supposed to go check it out, but he has since, you know, not responded to communications. And so now Al's Aces are being sent to check up on him, rescue him, and see what's going on at this drug farm. Basically, to sum up this mission, again, it's like a special little, It's like a small hideout in the land of stench. They go and it's kind of got like, it's like, there are, it's basically a secluded area of the marsh that is basically like, there's a gardens of drugs being grown. I actually had a list of all the different things that they had.
Ooh, like magic D&D drugs?
Yeah, kind of. Stuff like that. Like, it's... Let's see, we got... whoops, where do we... Yep, we got tangling ivy, mushrooms, razor grass... but most importantly, they had these things called fear leaf trees. And the important thing about the fear leaf trees is that the fear leaf trees were producing a fear effect that was being used to keep the captive in the base in place. Basically, the spores being put off by the trees, by the fear leaf trees, cause a natural kind of revulsion and fear response in its victims. And so they come to rescue Abu, and he's sort of like held in place by these fear leaf trees. And of course the players also have to avoid their effects as well as they are traversing the drug den. There also, of course, there's like four goblin guards, and they've got a couple of like wolf guard dogs. There's a few other prisoners as well, one of whom has like been driven insane by like exposure to the fear leaves and the various like drugs and whatnot. And are you familiar with the monster the Grick?
The Grick? Ah, man. You know, not off the top of my head, but that name rings a bell so hard.
It's like...
What's the Grick?
It's like a snaky monster with a beak, and it's like if the end of a snake just sort of unfolded into four tentacles with a beak in the middle.
That's right.
They slink around the rocks and stuff, and so slinking around this drug den in the area of the fear leaf trees, sort of keeping watch over the captives, is a Grick. Waiting to attack anyone who frees the captives. And so this operation was basically they had to do a prison break at a sort of like mad drug den in the land of stench. But the other thing to note is that when they like, so they also, they were searching through this area and attempting to find signs of like night side eclipse connections, and while they did not necessarily find that, they found a message like scrawled in the ground in the area, or like scrawled on the stones in the area of the drug den, just a very strange and ominous message being written all over the place, basically in the area, that read, "Hell hath no loyalty." And the players didn't really know what to make of that, and brought the intel back to Al-Samasath and relayed that to him. And while that message will become important in the future, for the time being, all that happened is they managed to infiltrate the Garden of Fear, rescue their fellow agent and the prisoners that were being held there. There was also... one thing was, like, they were able... I had a whole thing where, like, you could, in combat, basically, players or enemies could cut down fear leaf trees as, like, a timber attack that, like, makes a tree fall on an enemy. Just for a bit of fun there. But, yeah, they rescue their fellow agent. They rescue the other prisoners. And also... since they had just basically secured a drug den or a drug farm in the land of stench, Chessie Dildira, the somewhat mischievous drow rogue, went out of her way to secure some quantity of drugs, which that will also come into play later on.
I really like how you always have the operatives, the sort of, you know, the MPOC agents or Al's Aces, are always sort of dealing with forms of organized crime, but in this D&D fantasy setting. I really appreciate that. Like, I rarely think to do things like, you know, they raid a drug plantation or have to track down an arms dealer. Those, to me, those adventure hooks always stick in my mind as like a more modern setting or like a cyberpunk setting. And I really appreciate that you have them in a more fantasy setting.
Yeah, it's definitely...
Wouldn't think to do it.
It's definitely part of, like, designing everything to be part of this kind of... Like, MPOC is, like, an introduction of, like, the super spy genre into D&D, basically. And that, I think, is, like, where the influence for the mission design comes in. But also, like, I think it is worth mentioning that, like, it's fairly compelling. I recently played through the original The Witcher game, and, like, say what you will about the game, but one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that in this medieval fantasy setting, one of the sort of the evil conspiracy or organization that you were attempting to dismantle, one aspect of that in the main quest of the game is that they are funding their operations through the sale of an addictive drug that is basically just like magic cocaine in the setting of The Witcher called Fistech. And the fact is that, like, because it's an addictive drug and it's so popular in like the slums of this medieval city, it provides like really like quite a lot of working capital, like gold, for the coffers of this evil organization so that they can have a much more expansive and powerful operation. And it's not the kind of thing that you see often in a fantasy setting, but like, yeah, it makes perfect sense. It's like, you know, have that sort of criminal aspect to any evil organization because, you know, bad guys got to make money. They got to have funds for their evil plots.
Absolutely. And I mean, why not have that kind of organized crime in a fantasy setting? It's just the kind of thing that wouldn't offhandedly occur to me. I don't think I've ever had, you know, a fantasy party go in, you know, it's like you have to go undercover to infiltrate a drug den or something like that.
I think it's also interesting because, like, in the case of these MPOC examples, what I'm really doing is, like, I'm using the sort of modern crime investigation like mission as a setup or as a framing device, but like the you know, the overarching enemy of the MPOC is still the Nightside Eclipse, and this is kind of my way of providing something that, like, you know, they're being sent first of all on missions that may have a Nightside Eclipse connections, but are not, like, you know, their first missions are not, you know, go fight the Nightside Eclipse. Their first missions are deal with something that is more in the pay grade of, like, low-level adventurers like yourselves, and see if this ties back to the Nightside Eclipse. And that lets me sort of, like, scale up the conflict as I go by, like, keeping hands off on the main sort of us versus them until the players are a little bit more established.
I like it. Though I would have described a lot more smells in that adventure.
Yeah, I saw in my notes I had, like, In the Garden of Fear, I had, like, Sounds of Madness was in the notes, but I didn't have anything about, like, special smells, so I don't know. So what about Eberron Session 2? Does this campaign have a name?
I just called it Eberron. It's what it's called in my notes. I think I might have developed one as it went along when the players finally decided upon a name for their band. I think I started calling it after that, but I just call it Eberron. It's the only campaign I've run in the Eberron setting, and whenever I, like, if I mention it to my players who played in this, they just go, oh yeah, Eberron.
Maybe call it, like, Eberron World Tour or
Everon World Tour is pretty good.
No sleep till whatever their last stop is.
no sleep till Greenheart.
Live sure. in Eberron. Ooh, Live in Eberron's good.
Yeah, all right. Let's call it Live in Eberron for the purposes of the podcast. So, last adventure, the players had investigated the river of the small town of Varna had become polluted following the death of the local druid. And so they investigated the cause of the pollution and discovered that it was because there was a wayward cyclops that was defecating upriver. And they killed the cyclops. They investigated the druid's cabin and then returned to Varna to be celebrated by the locals. And at the end of the adventure, they were figuring out where they wanted to go next to find a new gig for their band. And you had commented that you were surprised the players didn't try to intervene when the druid Falsmere was executed by the Enforcer Elite at the beginning of the adventure. And they didn't try to intervene because they were so low level and they were just passing through. They weren't even locals. They didn't know the druid, so they sort of stayed out of his affairs. But following investigating his cabin and, you know, realizing that he had been keeping the cyclops at bay and helping out with the local livestock and all that, they realized that, you know, this character who died was actually like a really good person, a really good guy. And the druid of the party, Marcus, who is the drummer, he started feeling really bad that he hadn't intervened and that they let the druid sort of die in front of them. And so as they were deciding where to go next, Marcus said, well, wherever we go, it should be west of here so that I can stop by Greenheart, which is in the center of the towering woods of Eberron, and see the great druid tree, Olian. And there isn't actually a lot written about Olian in the Eberron source books, but effectively Olian is like a stationary treant, a stationary ent, just this gigantic sentient pine that lives in the middle of the towering woods in a settlement called Greenheart. And he oversees an order of druids called the Wardens of the Wood, who protect the Greenheart and the Towering Woods from exterior threats. And because Marcus wasn't one of the Wardens of the Wood, but his former home was the Towering Woods, so he figures, okay, we'll get Falsmere the druid's body, and we'll head west. Make sure our next gig is somewhere west of here, and then stop at Greenheart and see if Olian can maybe bring Falsmere back, or just, you know, do anything to make sure his passing wasn't in vain. Basically, just like seek out the head druid, say this druid died, impart the news, and maybe this magic tree will be able to do something.
Determine his successor as prophesied by the seeing tree.
Sure, something along those lines. But yeah, Marcus just like felt a duty to do right by Falsmere and make sure that his body is laid to rest properly, or maybe he can even be brought back. And so they decide that yeah, they're gonna head west. They're going to head to a place called Lorvian, which is just like a town, but bigger than Varna. And they set off in that direction. Now, before I get into the meat of the adventure, it was at this point that I decided to weave in a prefab campaign that I had found on dndadventure.com. I wish I could attribute it to the person who wrote it, but they just go by the name D&D Gamer. And this prefab campaign is called the Masks of Destiny campaign. And the Masks of Destiny campaign, I didn't really like weave in a lot of the central plot of it, because ultimately the Masks of Destiny campaign is just the Lord of the Rings, but with masks instead of rings. there is this big evil sorcerer named Zoth who had forged these different
magic masks. Hey, Zoth the Radiant Anarchy is the patron of the Empok.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Is it spelled with an X?
No, no, it's spelled with a Z.
This one is Zoth, X-O-T-H.
Zoth the Radiant Anarchy, who the players met in Empok's Finest when they traveled to the Far Realms.
This is Zoth the Teng Sorcerer, Forger of the Masks. And the idea behind these masks is that there are a whole bunch of them. How many are there, actually? I should pull this up. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are 8 masks, and they each have a unique ability, and they each have a degree of intellect, but they can only communicate telepathically with whoever wears them. And one of the conceits of these magic masks is that you can, when sort of overlaid with each other, they become sort of like the Ultra Mask, essentially. They all sort of fuse together and become this uber powerful, but ultimately evil magical device.
It should be said that, like, the main flagship, like, first adventure that they put out for 5th edition, Horde of the Dragon Queen, also has basically this setup where the Cult of the Dragon is attempting to get the different dragon masks, like one for each color, and then I think you merge them all together to make the Mask of Tiamat, and then that's an evil dragon mask.
I wonder if the Masks of Destiny was ultimately absorbed, because it was written, I want to say, in like 2001 or 2002. So I kind of wonder if whoever D&D gamer is went on to write for Wizards of the Coast and ported over the Masks of Destiny. And of course, it is like I said, this is just like Lord of the Rings. Zoth was killed by an order of good mages, but he managed to put his soul into a phylactery and is seeking to come back. And of course, when all of the masks are combined and then a ritual is performed, Zoth will be able to return.
That's literally in Horde of the Dragon Queen in Rise of Tiamat. The dragon cult is trying to get the dragon masks so that they can combine into the Mask of Tiamat, which will be used in a ritual to summon Tiamat out of hell, Avernus. And
Wow. Okay. So now I have not read the Horde of the Dragon Queen module. So now I'm between podcast recordings. I am going to look into this and see if the Masks of Destiny wound up just being used as a basis for that, maybe with the author's permission or even the author themselves working on it. But that's really funny. So basically, I'm doing that. The character Nikto in the party is a masker class, like a custom class who uses magic masks to perform his spells. And so I figured, well, hey, why not use the Masks of Destiny as a framework for Nikto's own storyline within this campaign? And I generally try to do that. I try to give each player their own sort of subplot. And so it was at this point where I was like, okay, yeah, Nikto, he can do the Masks of Destiny. Now, the reason I mention it doesn't factor into this adventure too much, but this is where I start planting the seeds of the Masks of Destiny, which come into play later on. And you can still read the Masks of Destiny campaign at dndadventure.com. Just search the site for the Masks of... You can just Google Masks of Destiny, and it's still there if you want to read up on it. So that's sort of the setup. The players are going west. They're going to stop by at Greenheart, meet with the Druid Tree, and then proceed on to another gig further west of there. But they don't quite get there yet because I decided this is the first time I ever ran it, that on their way through the woods, they were going to run into Buford Chabon, the friend of Brad Burtness, and go play some Spottle at the Spottle Parlor.
There we go. Now we got it.
Yeah. So I ran at the Spottle Parlor pretty straight up with a few little extra details to tie it into the setting. And I'll do like a quick recap of At the Spottle Parlor in case people are listening and they didn't hear when I've talked about it previously. But this was from Dungeon Magazine, and the premise is that there's like a legendary Robin Hood style hero, now retired, named Brad Burtness, and in his retirement, he now hosts these nights of this gambling game called Spottle. And Spottle is a dice game, with the gimmick being that there's a giant frog in the middle of the table who might eat your dice at any moment. And if your dice are eaten, well, you lose that round. And you have to pay, like, you have to ante up to get more dice. The fun of the adventure, part of what I love, not only is it just a fun mini game to like engage your players and get them doing something a little different than standard D&D fare, rolling dice and like really role playing their characters as they're gambling, but there are also some great NPCs. There's a really sad sack cleric named Vanson who. He's trying to raise money to rebuild his order's shrine nearby, and he's constantly losing. And the fun of the character is that he's just so pathetic that he is constantly just like begging other players for help and donations. And oh my God, can't you see it in your heart to donate to help me restore my shrine? And I remember that Alan Dare in particular, it may have been Caitlin or it may have been Alan Dare or both, but they just hated Alan Dare, could not stand this cleric Vanson, just could not stand him and was getting so annoyed and found it just insufferable every time he like prostrated himself, supplicated himself before them begging. He was like, God, this guy's so awful and insufferable. One of the other players is a fat redheaded sort of slovenly kid named Gergi, who is really dim-witted and unbeknownst to the players until the climax of the adventure, he's also a weirboar. When he gets stressed out, he turns into a lycanthropic boar. And then the third NPC at the table with the players is a lizard man named Shkod. And Shkod's whole deal is that he constantly loses, but when he loses, he gets really angry and accuses everybody else of cheating. And he's sort of like a wild card. Like there's always the chance that he's going to sort of fly off the handle and attack them. And he's constantly, like, accusing other people of giving him the evil eye. And, you know, your presence is bad luck here. Hiss, hiss, hiss. So, as the party is going through the woods, they come upon Brad Burtness's friend, Buford Chabon, who is out looking for players for the Spottle game. And he coaxes them, like, come on. You know, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You can gamble with the legendary Brad Burtness. And coaxes them to the game room. And they all sit down and they start playing. And the way that I... And Brad, you know, they sit down at this semi-circular table, similar to, like, a table at a casino. And in this room, there's a big curtain, and from behind it, Brad Burtness comes out in this grand display and welcomes everyone to the game and introduces himself. And so the way I started seeding in the Masks of Destiny campaign is I included the detail that the walls here are decorated with colorful silk tapestries featuring scenes of jeweled mountains and rivers of gold, dragons and giants, with likenesses of Brad Burtness on his adventures and escapades. And then one of the tapestries bears a large image of an ornate mask composed of many different building materials. And it is the legendary Mask of Zoth. I had the player's role, Knowledge Arcane, and Nikto, of course, got a bonus. I didn't tell him he got a bonus, but he got a bonus because he knows masks.
I would have given him advantage.
Well, this was 3.5. So I think I just gave him like a +2 or a +3. And then there are, I included some details about that. And Nikto asked Bradbert about the tapestry, and he says, oh, you know, aren't they beautiful? There's a weaver in Nyrn that makes them. And I saw this one of the Mask of Zoth, and I had to commission the others for my collection. This one is of my defeat of Lady Vol. I think it's a masterpiece. It's as though the artist was there himself. And so they start playing, and the module includes like every round of the game with preset results for all the NPCs. Really handy. It makes it really easy and fluid to run. It never feels like the game is slowing down. And the conceit of this module is that you keep playing for longer than you should play. You basically keep playing Spottle until the players start catching on that, like, the game should be over by now, and Bradbert is keeping them there for some reason. Anytime a player runs out of money, Bradbert goes like, oh, well, guess what? This is the special Howling Toad round where everybody gets an additional 100 gold pieces. Everybody wins. Or, oh no, you know, the dealer sits out this round, so the pot automatically is divided between the players. Just coming up with any excuse for the game to continue. And at a certain point, the players will catch on to this, like something shady is going on. But right around that moment is when the door bursts open and some hobgoblins come in. And the leader of the hobgoblins is Lord Guz. And Lord Guz says, you know, oh, thank you for bringing me people for the goblin mines. And Bradbert, you know, goes, what? That wasn't our deal. And it turns out that Lord Guz had come to a previous game just the other night and lost terribly and threatened to kill Bradbert, but unless Bradbert brought him new players for a game so that he have a chance to win back his loss. Except as soon as Lord Guz turns up, he reveals like, no, he never intended to play again. He just wants to capture Bradbert and Bufrid and all the people at the table and haul them off to the Hobgoblin mines. And so there's a dust up. Gurgi, in a moment of stress, transforms into a boar. And combat ensues, and the players, in this case, they just bested the hobgoblins, and they were feeling very betrayed by Bradwardness, and Bufrid were furious with him, and so they demanded recompense. They got a bunch of loot off of Bradbert, and then also, were given instructions on the quickest route, if there was a shortcut that they could take to get to Greenheart. And so that's what they did. And because they were making really good time, I also had them arrive at Greenheart at the end of this adventure. So the small but well-worn path indicated by Bufrid Chavin affords you a quick and easy trip to the Towering Woods. The path stays away from almost all major routes. They travel by day, and I gave them a random wilderness encounter along the way, and then they arrive at Greenheart. And so they proceed to, you know, enter Greenheart, and it's this like lush, beautiful grove teeming with life. The path they're on just disappears into tall green grass. The fertility of the growth is like pouring out of it and being absorbed by the land. The forest floor has many single floor huts that have been sort of manifested up out of the ground using elemental magic. And then the trees are filled with like Ewok village style tree houses, Classic. Swings. zip lines, rope ladders, pulley operated elevators are everywhere. And the Wardens of the Wood are also everywhere, watching them enter. They're the largest druidic sect in this area of the Reaches, protectors of Greenheart, keepers of the Sacred Grove of Olian, and they can easily be recognized by their robes, which all look as though they've been crafted out of tree bark. And it's not uncommon for families to be seen, like, all wearing the same kind of tree bark. Some of them wear, like, curled white birch strips or ragged, bulky pine birchmen. Or, like, scaly oak armor. And so they go and they seek an audience with Olian. And Olian is, of course, you know, quite distressed to learn that Falsmir was killed. Falsmir wasn't a member of the Wardens of the Wood, but he was known in the region as being a very like a philanthropic druid. He asked very little in return for his services and was always eager to help, you know, farmers with their livestock and things like that. And Olian says he would, in fact, be able to perform a resurrection ritual if they had Falsmir's head as well as his body. I forgot to mention, the players decided they retrieved his body from from the coroner in Varna, but of course the head was taken by the Enforcer Elite. So they present the body to Olian, and Olian goes, well, I can only bring him back if you also have his head.
Classic and so D&D troubles.
Yeah, so this is like a stretch goal for them, as they want to find Falsmir's head on their travels. But to thank the players for, or thank the party for bringing the druid back to Greenheart, and at least being able to, you know, even if they can't resurrect him, at least he'll be able to be given a resting place amongst other members of this druidic order, and to sort of honor him. And to thank the players for that, the party is presented with Pegasi. They all get Pegasus mounts, especially because since they're going to be traveling everywhere, it was like, you know, forget fast travel, let's just have them fly. And so this adventure concludes with them riding out of Greenheart on their Pegasus mounts.
They're gonna need a flying wagon to tie those or a flying tour bus to tie those Pegasi to.
Yeah, I wish they had. But so this concluded with them getting a nice big score. They got a bunch of money and jewels from Bradbert Nyss. Nikto learned about the Masks of Destiny, and they all got some cool mounts, man.
It's funny, it's worth mentioning that, like, I may have even said this before. I've talked about how the campaign after Alsace's Coyote's Aegis that I ran started off as being based on, like, Oregon Trail, being like an Oregon Trail adventure. And that was also, like, strongly influenced by sort of Band on the Road stories and narratives. And so one of the things in that is that I did have them, like, over time upgrade from, like, a caravan to, like, a big tour bus.
Part of what Oregon Trail was definitely an inspiration for this one. And as I was going through my notes, I realized that Eberron as a campaign sort of is set apart from most of the campaigns I run, because it has very little in the way of, like, overarching stories. The Masks of Destiny campaign is sort of woven through it, but it's much more, like, episodic. And in a way, I kind of prefer that. Like, it's nice to have a big overarching story and a background plot, but just being able to do these little, like, you arrive here and you have this weird encounter and then you go on your merry way. And I really enjoyed running that kind of campaign.
I'm usually, like, I usually want it to be bigger, consisting of bigger chunks than just, like, the single episodes. But it is something that I've thought about recently, especially, like, I know we've talked a little bit about the podcast, The Adventure Zone, and, you know, in the first two seasons of The Adventure Zone, when it was run by Griffin McElroy, the plot is divided into arcs, the way that I have done, like, MPOX Finest, for example. I had all those different arcs. And listening to the third season of The Adventure Zone, where it's Travis McElroy, and he doesn't really seem to employ that same strategy, I think, like, it's really, I'm really missing it, is the thing. I think I'm beginning to value more and more the, like, the framing device of telling your larger narrative in smaller, like, identifiable pieces. I think that's really important to the pacing of a role-playing game campaign, to be honest.
I think that RPG campaigns can really benefit from that style of storytelling, because it's almost like it requires the players to remember less from session to session. Like when I was running campaigns like Minds of Metal and Wheels, like every game would start with a big recap of what happened last time. But I remember for the Eberron campaign, it was always just like, oh yeah, we're going there, right? You know, they didn't even necessarily have to think like, oh yeah, there was a Cyclops, we defeated a Cyclops, we explored that druid. It was just like, oh yeah, the druid's dead, so we're going there.
I think it's worth mentioning too, I think it's also, it's a narrative device that, like, serves comic books fairly well as well. And I think the similarity there is, like, the way in which you follow your character in a role-playing game is similar to following, like, a superhero in a comic. And you have that sort of situation. It's like if Batman or Superman or X-Men was all just one continuing story with no, like, delineation of the arcs in between, it'd just be, like, an impossible to follow story.
Yeah, absolutely.
I recently read through the history of the Darkness comic, and tell you, that's a story that got off the rails, but they got their arcs. Just like any comic book, gotta have your arcs, put your trade paperbacks out based on the arcs, etc.
Is that a recommendation for the Darkness comics, or no?
No. Just the fact that the Darkness does a thing that other comics do pretty historically, I don't think that's a recommendation. And moreover, I've said this to you, but you know a comic book has gone off the rails when you're looking at the Wikipedia page and you learn that at some point in the continuity, the protagonist literally rewrote the universe so that none of the rules of the comic from the start of the series apply anymore. And if I may go on a minor tangent, it's wild that the Darkness does this because Spawn literally did the same thing. It's mandatory behavior for fucking edgy ass 90s anti-heroes. You start off with a bunch of restrictions on your powers, and then by the end of it, the writers have decided that those restrictions didn't help them sell comics.
Man, again, not to go too far on a tangent, but I can't remember the name of it. It was the stupid thing, but did you hear about the hentai that started World War II? Do you hear about this thing?
No. Unless
so it's
a hentai that is World War II. I believe that.
No, it's not real. Like it didn't actually start World War II, but there, you can read up on it. I wish I could remember the name of the stupid character, but it was like a fan. It was just like a person created their own fantasy anime hentai character that was like a furry style anthropomorphic wolf with angel wings that have yin yang patterns on them. And it's exactly that thing that you're describing, where it turns out that this character was behind every major world event. And of course, after this was written up somewhere online, the jokers at like 4chan got a hold of it and started drawing the most ridiculous scenarios imaginable involving this character that supposedly rewrote the whole continuity of Earth. And one of them is this character, like, basically like puppeteering the person who assassinated the Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, this is weird to get onto, but it's funny because for me, the darkness gets past so much of that because the fiction is supposed to be that, like, the darkness is responsible for most misery in human history. Like, I could totally buy if they had any number of darkness comics that go back to a historical event and show how the darkness was responsible. It's the fact that, like, the whole thing of the darkness is that he's not allowed to have kids because then he spreads the darkness to the kid and it leaves him. And also, like, his girlfriend was killed off and that's, like, his tragic backstory. But now his girlfriend's alive and he has a kid with his girlfriend. But the kid is a kid that he had with a different character previously in the continuity. But when he rewrote the world so that his girlfriend was alive, he decided he would have had the kid with that girlfriend and not the one that he did in the storyline. Like, it's that kind of, like, writer just being like, I'm tired of the way this story works. I'm gonna switch it up.
So just to finish my thought, I looked it up and I learned about this. There's a guy on YouTube named Justin Wang, and yes, he made a video about the furry who assassinated Franz Ferdinand and caused World War One. So you can look up the video by Justin Wang to learn the full history of this ridiculous thing.
And with that, are we hitting the tavern?
Yeah, I think we better before we go too far down this rabbit hole.
I think we're already in the tavern by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I think we are.
A few drinks in. What do you got for the tavern, Mugil?
So I wanted to do something a little different. We always, we're talking about magic items or adventure modules in the tavern. And it occurred to me that I didn't actually know that much about how Dungeons & Dragons was marketed in, you know, ye olden times, circa first or second edition. I only ever really paid attention to the marketing from when I got into it until now. And there was a time where it was definitely aimed more at children, and there were a lot of interesting, like, D&D products that were put out. So this time, I've brought a selection of just funny D&D products that I've found from, like, the 70s and 80s. And I thought I'd share them with you, Tom. And what we're going to do is
send you some pictures. Dungeons & Dragons roller coaster.
Yeah, I still haven't. The D&D cartoon starts with them getting on a Dungeons & Dragons roller coaster, and I'm pretty sure that still doesn't exist. But there are some weird things, weird D&D products that do exist. And so first I'm going to start by sending you this ad, just advertising first edition Dungeons & Dragons. And they were trying to definitely appeal to, like, teenagers and older by going kind of sexy with it.
Oh, no. I mean.
So this ad.
It could be worse. It could be like those 90s Game Boy commercials, but, like, this is still bad.
Yeah. But this is pretty bad. So the photo depicts a sexy lady wearing a leopard print dress and heels, a short dress, a very short dress, and heels, and she is posing seductively in front of two TSR displays of first edition D&D manuals. And the tagline says, "Where the action is, the eye-catching merchandise from TSR holds such top-selling games as Dungeons & Dragons, Warlocks and Warriors, and Dungeon." And there's another one where she's sexily holding the monster manual and it says, "What's in demand today? Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual, $9.95 retail. Available from your distributor or TSR Direct." I think this is hilarious. Like you said, it could be worse, but just the fact that they thought to try and market it this, like, she's not even really, if they'd put her in, like, one of those, you know, Red Sonja chainmail bikinis or something, so it was a little more on theme, I'd get it. But just, like, generic sexy pose in leopard print holding up the monster manual, man. That really cracks me up. But let's get into some actual D&D products. And some of these I had no idea existed. And, like, I kind of wish we still had these kinds of D&D products. Like, how about this one here? This is the Fortress of Fangs playset. Unlock the secrets of the evil dungeon. Fortress of Fangs has over 12 action features, including a flying evil creature throne, a moving wall of spikes, a secret trap door, a catapult platform, a hidden treasure slide, a falling hatchet, a hidden pull-out ladder, and a weapons rack. It's like it's basically a He-Man set, really. It's like a He-Man base, and there was a whole line of Dungeons & Dragons action figures and monsters that you could buy, and this was just a place for you to play with them. I think that thing is great. That thing's really awesome. To go with it, here's another one. Your very own Tiamat five-headed evil dragon action figure. It has claw-grabbing legs to capture and carry away Tiamat's victims. Poseable heads with bendable necks. The tongue moves as menacing jaws open and close on the middle head. Flexible wings. Like, that's a pretty solid action figure. Made by LJN, I'll note. LJN responsible for, like, every tie-in product of the 80s. But like, damn, dude, you know, nowadays, you mostly get statuettes and figurines for D&D. I kind of wish there were, like, some nice plastic action figures like this. I'd feel less bad throwing this thing around, you know, instead of a figurine that somebody spent a lot of time painting.
I mean, I got my thing for old Spawn action figures. I don't think those are going strong anymore, but back in the day, man, love me some Spawn.
Yeah.
Some Spawn figures. And
you can search online and find all sorts of D&D action figures from, you know, the 70s and 80s from this Advanced Dungeons & Dragons line. There are fighters, there are rogues, you know, all the classics. But I figured you would appreciate this one, Tom, and that is the Shambling Mound action figure.
I mean, it is
with a treasure sack.
It is pretty great, but, you know, I was kind of hoping it'd be a gibbering mouther.
Oh, you know what? I just came across this one, but let me see if there's a gibbering mouther out there. I don't know if they made a classic one. I'm only coming up with figurines.
Oh, wow.
From the Monster Menagerie collection. Too bad.
Because that would bring me onto one of the things I was bringing to the tavern.
Well, I got three more products here that I want to share with you. Okay. And we're going to get a little weirder now.
Is this going to be like one of those Jar Jar Binks things where his tongue is candy?
Well, okay, if you want to go in that direction. It's not quite as weird as the Jar Jar Binks lollipop with the candy tongue.
Yeah, here we go. Candy fighter?
Yeah, they just made candy figures. Like, candy figures from D&D. You can see the fighter there, but they also had, like, there's a troglodyte one. There's an ogre.
They should go back to selling class-based candy so that you could be like, ah, I got my warlock candy. Well, I got my cleric candy.
There were a bunch of, there's like maybe a minotaur, flavors. Magic user, there's an owlbear. Like, that would be great.
I love the old school magic users.
And then there's also, here's another fun one.
Ah, this is good. I like that. Pinball.
Classic AD&D pinball game. It's Plinko. It's one of those old plastic Plinko games with the little tiny, like, like BB style balls in it, and the spring loaded trigger, and you sort of shoot it and try to get it in the little pockets for different point values. And really the only thing that makes it D&D is it has a piece of Dungeons and Dragons art as the background, and at the bottom it says myths and magic.
You should have used one of these at the end of Riddles of the Sphinx. You remember that?
Oh yeah. Wow, deep cut.
Deep cut.
Deep cut with Riddles of the Sphinx. Man, now I gotta like, when I post about this episode on our WordPress, I'm gonna have to track down a clip of Riddles of the Sphinx to put there. See if I can get the little Mercury maze thing.
That'd be amazing.
Amazing. And then the last one that I wanted to mention, I couldn't find an image of it that I could link to, but if you go on YouTube, there's a channel called My Side of the Laundry Room, and this guy does a few videos called Weird, Rare, and Awesome D&D Products from the 80s. And the one that I wanted to mention was there was a, I guess it's like an oven, you could call it, but it's basically like the toy Creepy Crawlers. You know the toy Creepy Crawlers? Yeah, Creepy Crawlers being these little like pewter molds of bugs, and you pour like colored goop into the molds, and then you bake the mold, and you basically make your own rubber bugs. And there was one of those for D&D, one of those ovens, and the molds were like monsters and classes, like fighter.
Man,
and
so that idea and the candy idea are still quality ideas. Like, people would totally go in for these. I mean, that's basically a cheap 3D printer for D&D.
Yeah, exactly. Like, make your own figurines. Just, you know, if I was a kid, I would have loved that stuff, especially if I was a kid, like, actually playing D&D with a battle map with my friends. It would be so great to show up and be like, here's my character. And then the monsters are all candy, and when you beat the monster, you get to eat it. It's a great idea.
Used to do that in a fourth edition, because you'd have those minions that you hit them, you kill them, so just have all the minions be little gummies.
Oh, fantastic. I love it. Bring back edible D&D.
Okay. I'll do my best.
Anyway, that's the recap of some unusual D&D products that we just don't see anymore, man.
So I gave a shout a little bit earlier to the Gibbering Mouther, declaring my loyalty because I recently lost a large sum of imaginary currency in support of the Gibbering Mouther. For those of you who don't know, there's something on the internet called Salty Bet. It's a long-running system wherein basically it's like a Twitch channel where people watch randomized bot-controlled fighting game matches between like random fighting game characters. And they got just a million characters all thrown in there. You can see like Jotaro Kujo fight Chester Cheeto or Sauron fight Vegeta or some nonsense like that. It's all random and people bet fake currency called salt on it. And so someone has come up with a D&D version of this called Goblin Bet, wherein you can tune in to see random matchups of one-on-one Dungeons and Dragons monsters and bet your little gold pieces that they allot you on who you think's going to win. But Gibbering Mouther, not cut out to beat a bandit captain, which has a 3x multi-attack. And, I spend all my imaginary currency to back that history's greatest monster. So check out Goblin Bet. Meanwhile, I thought since I was concluding the Defiance and Flan module that I had been using for my own adventure, I would wrap up the mini adventures that I've talked about in that little module. The first one being a shock at Even Feast. Basically, the players are at a dinner at Madame Friona's Tea Kettle. It's like I said earlier, you've got this setup. In the original module, there are six tables. That explains some of my confusion earlier. But the point is, you have these six tables. There's a party going on. The players are trying not to draw attention to the fact that they know something is up, but somebody is attempting to deal a potentially dangerous item, a blue dragon's tooth that is still enchanted with volatile lightning energy, is inside a glass sphere, a heavily padded glass sphere. And one of the tricks in the module as written is that once the players do like catch on to who has it, they inevitably spook the person who has the item, and they in turn inevitably smash the glass sphere, which releases the lightning energy from the tooth, at which point the lightning energy begins jumping from person to person, and you sort of have to chase the effects of the magic item from table to table. And the solution is to actually bottle the lightning. You need to find a glass container, basically, and catch the lightning in it before it jumps to another bystander. Bystanders that get hit by the lightning, oddly enough, like sort of enter a trance, walk out into the street outside, and then form a circle. So like each person who gets zapped goes and stands out in the street outside holding hands in a circle until there's this weird sort of like electric circuit of people outside. And there's something that I don't quite understand about the design of the module. I mean, I guess I get that like what they were trying to do was create a way of solving the puzzle so you can figure out how, like, who the lightning is going to jump to next. But basically, there's a thing where, like, the way to disrupt the lightning is by figuring out that it's jumping from, like, different materials from a local area called the Quivering Forest. Basically, like, I had the whole thing with the Land of Stench, and it's like, okay, you have one person has a bow that's made of wood from the Land of Stench, one person has, like, a magic pen,
whatever. A stinky bow.
Right. But what the way that would work in this module is basically one person would have a bow that is made of rare wood from the forest. The food critic says that there is too much safflower seed in his food, which you can make a check to realize that that grows locally only within the Quivering Forest. And basically the lightning is for some reason jumping from one natural thing to another. There's one person who's like selling flowers and it jumps to them. And so the way that you draw the lightning into the bottle is by using like a flower or something like that, one of these natural items to attract it, and then you bottle it up. So that, like, you know, it's more or less as I ran it, but with a few little extra complications that I thought were worth mentioning. And then finally, the last mini adventure is The Danger at Dusk, which is a distraught gnome comes looking for adventurers to rescue his missing daughter, and that leads the adventurers to discover a secret prison with a secret entrance in a tunnel leading from the river into some ruins nearby. And there's basically the ruins are, there's the prison area, there's a guard room, and then there is a area that the guards refer to as the fun house, which is basically a place, it has a grick, but it is filled with like cages and ruined obelisks that create the fear effect rather than the fear leaf trees that I had sort of come up with. And so the idea is that, like, in order to break the prisoners or to punish them, the guards occasionally move them into the cages in the funhouse, where they are overcome by fear by the obelisks and guarded by the grick. But also a special thing that they do in the original module is that once you rescue the prisoners from within the funhouse and fight the Grick, once you come back into the guard area and the prison, there's actually another adventurer there, a representative of the group, the Order of the Gauntlet, who is following up on like a similar lead to what you are. And she basically explains to you what's going on. Like, this is a plot by like corrupt guards within the city to sort of like sell these kidnapped victims to the Cult of the Dragon and experiment on them. Yeah, basically, again, pretty similar to how I ran it, but just like a little bit more traditional in its dungeon design, and also adding this thing where like the players don't have all the information from the start, and so as they're leaving, they actually run into another adventurer who sort of gives them a little bit more intel on the situation. And that concludes Defiance in Flan, a series of 5 mini adventures that introduce new players to the setting of Flan, the main city hub of season 1 of the 5th edition Adventurers League.
This just makes me want flan. Break out the flan, everybody.
So what is flan?
Oh, flan? It's like custard.
Okay, so here's the thing. I didn't ask that so much as like I didn't know what it was, because you mentioned it before. The reason I asked that, and this is, I appreciate, a very non-D&D tangent, is when I was in high school, I went on like a school trip to Vimy Ridge, and we stayed in the city of Lille in France, which I liked quite a lot. But while we were staying in the city, I guess our school had cut this deal with a restaurant in Lille called Flam, and it was like Flam, but with an with an M, like
right,
like monkey, not N, like now or something.
Like flame without an E.
Yes. And to be honest, I don't even remember how exactly the spelling is or whatever, or if like someone had mispronounced it or something. No, I'm pretty sure it's flame. Anyway, the point is, what this place sold was basically like French sauceless pizza. It was like what flam is, I guess, is just like a pillowy bed of like pizza doughy, like cooked dough, and then you put toppings on it, but there's no sauce. So it's just like really dry, and like sometimes the topping choices were really whack, like just like cheese and onion. And it's like, come on, man. But then other times it'd be really good. They'd have like cheese and steak and potato on a flam, and that was good. But man, you know, it's funny. The people on that school trip got so sick of flam after like the second night that they literally started passing on like the free meal at this restaurant in Lille to go order McDonald's. I stayed for the free flam every night, even as it got progressively lazier in concept. And they stopped doing the steak and potato one. But, and they had dessert flams that were just like icing or like marshmallow melted on it. Weird dish, man. And like, as far as I know, just some like weird thing that this restaurant made up. I don't know that this is some French food or something.
Well, I had to look it up, and I'm pleased to report that Flam's French Pizza is still in operation.
And is it like, so that makes it sound like that is the one place.
It's the only one I could find. Flams.com.
Man, that's totally accurate. French pizza. It's like pizza, but it's worse.
And I'm
shots fired.
I'm looking at it right now. And they do indeed appear to be pizzas without sauce. The traditional flam is beef, bacon, and onions.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I'm down with that until the onions really, it's the onions give a little bit of a, why are we talking about this? Anyway, my point is, flam, like,
they've expanded their menu, though. Look, they have more traditional pizzas, though.
Oh, well, that's amazing, okay? This is my whole complaint, is that flam French pizza is a fucking bogus offer. Nobody wants to buy a pizza without sauce, okay? Or like some, you know, like there have been times that I've had a pizza and I've been like, this is too much sauce. Or maybe I've even thought, huh, I wonder if a pizza without sauce would be good. But let me tell you, not at the amount of effort that I received.
So it's short for Flammkuchen, which is German for flame cake, composed of bread rolled out thinly in the shape of a rectangle or oval, covered in creme fraiche, thin sliced onions, and bacon.
You know what? That explains so much that it's in creme fraiche and not cheese. Gross.
Yeah. Served at the French-German border region.
I mean,
you can get it with Gruyere.
Oh, is that Vimy Ridge?
And look, here's the sweet version. Apples and cinnamon.
See, that was good.
Or flambéed with calvados or another sweet liqueur.
Anyways,
it was created by Germanic farmers, and it made its urban restaurant debut in the pizza craze of the 60s.
The other thing is that, like, I'm sure if you go to this place, you can just order whatever great thing you want on the menu. I was there with, like, a flailing understanding of the language and just, like, kind of a burnt-out, like, lazy traveling student energy. So I'm sure that, like, my complaints about their unique offering, which they were serving me for free, fell on deaf ears.
I hope when you were served a pizza without sauce, you went, what kind of flim flam is this?
You know, I remember two standout moments that people thought were very funny from those dinners. One is that when some friends of mine said that they were sick of flam, I said, how could you be? It's flam-tastic. They thought that was stupid. And then at one point, they were serving us flams, and I said to the waitress, je suis des oignons? Non. As a way of trying to imply that I wanted no further onions on my flam.
But in fact, you were telling her that you weren't onions.
Or I was onions, no, more accurately.
Well, you said, je suis des oignons? That's I am onions.
Yeah, that's the thing. Je suis des oignons, no. I just added an emphatic no after saying I am onions.
No.
Yeah, exactly. And they kept feeding me damn onions. Anyways.
So it wasn't actually that flam-tastic.
No, it wasn't. So I think that every night after I got the steak and potato one, I was just hoping they would serve that again, and they didn't. I imagine that was one of the more high-end items on the menu. But anyways, this has been a long, long tangent to end on about flam.
More like a flamgent.
True that. So, if you want to get in touch with me and tell me why I'm wrong about flam on Twitter, you can hit me up at Narnog, NAR_NOG. If you want to talk to us on Facebook, follow the podcast on Facebook, be a fan, like it. You can hit us up on Compare and Campaign on Facebook. And finally, and most importantly, if you want to see our show notes and go back to the second entry of our WordPress where we have the map of Drail for all to see, then check out compareandcampaign.wordpress.com, where we post little links to all the stuff we talk about.
Now I want some flam.
Not me.